Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
The United States is set to start its withdrawal from the INF Treaty with Russia next month. Trade ministers to meet in Japan for the first CPTPP Commission meeting on Saturday. China to use its Long March 6 carrier rocket to launch 90 satellites for an Argentine company. Democrats asked Donald Trump to delay State of the Union speech. You're listening to Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, we'll have an hour of world news and analysis. To hear this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. The United States on Wednesday rejected Russia's offer to save a treaty that keeps nuclear missiles out of Europe, setting the stage for Washington to withdraw from what's known as the INF Treaty. The 1987 treaty bans land-based missiles with a range between 500 kilometers and 5,500 kilometers. After a meeting in Geneva between Russia and U.S. officials, U.S. Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security Andrea Thompson said Moscow refused to allow an inspection of a Russian missile system that Washington says violates the treaty. The U.S. says it will begin withdrawing from the pact on February the 2nd, a process that will take 6 months. For more on this, we are now joined on the line by Zhao Tone, fellow in Carnegie's Nuclear Policy Program based at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy. Good evening, Dr. Zhao. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Moscow had offered to allow U.S. experts to inspect the suspect missile. Why has it been rejected by Washington?
Well, the American position is Russians have not been very forthcoming in acknowledging the existence of this missile for many years. The United States told the Russians that we knew you have developed this missile. Actually, we knew you have deployed some of these missile systems. But Russia simply responded that, what missile are you talking about? After United States presented more technical information about this missile, Russia started to acknowledge its existence. But that was not enough for the United States. The U.S. seems very confident about its intel conclusion that this Russian missile has explicitly violated this treaty, and therefore there is only one option for Russia, which is to completely destroy all the missiles that have already been built and to also destroy all its associated launchers and other systems. And that's not an option for Russia. Russia is willing to go as far as presenting this missile in front of American inspectors and may allow the United States to take some measurement of this missile to verify its compliance with the treaty, but that falls short of the American demand. Therefore, their recent meeting in Geneva failed to make a breakthrough, and it looks like the United States is moving closer towards officially walking out of the treaty.
But does the United States have any evidence in saying that? Because Moscow accused the U.S. of exacerbating the situation. So has Russia been violating the treaty or not, as the U.S. claimed?
Well, the key problem in this dispute is the United States relies on very secretive intelligence collecting technologies and methodologies to identify these missile. And the U.S. is very reluctant to release more information about this missile, which the U.S. Worries might divulge too much of how they came to know about this missile. They worry that releasing too much information about this missile will help the Russians know about the U.S. intelligence collecting capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why so far the U.S. has been very reluctant to provide more detailed information the U.S. Tried to convince the international community, including its allies, that this is indeed a very serious violation. It has held briefings to its NATO allies, but different countries came out of those meetings with different conclusions. Some believe there is a smoking gun of Russian violation, but others are less convinced. So in one word, it's, there are too much uncertainty, and it is difficult for people without access to classified information to make any definitive conclusion.
And also, Russia is also accusing the United States of violating the treaty, right?
Yes, Russia also made some counter-arguments against the United States and basically said the U.S. also violated this treaty for three reasons. One is that the U.S. Aegis Ashore system uses the same launcher that can also fire offensive cruise missiles. Secondly, the United States has deployed long-range unmanned area vehicles, which the Russians believe is a new type of cruise missiles. And thirdly, the United States has used some medium-range missiles in their testing of their missile defense interceptors as the targets of the interceptors. And the Russians believe that's another violation. You know, to be fair, there is some good argument about the American Aegis Ashore systems launcher. However, those the two other Russian arguments about the unmanned area vehicles and the targets in American missile defense tests, those don't hold much water.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I think maybe we'll need some background information here. So could you tell us more about this Cold War era arms control treaty? How did it play out in history, and how much does it still matters today?
So basically, in the middle of the Cold War, especially in the 1970s, both the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union and the United States, developed and deployed some medium-range ground-launched ballistic missiles. In the Russian case, the SS-20 system. In the American case, the Pershing II ballistic missiles. That makes the confrontation between the two big powers more dangerous because these short and medium-range missiles were more likely to be used in a military crisis than longer range missiles or especially intercontinental ballistic missiles. And if they were used, the European countries might be the target. So the deployment of such missiles also made American NATO allies extremely worried about their security. So to resolve this problem, the former Soviet Union and the United States decided to reach a treaty that completely bans the development and deployment of ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. And that's the INF treaty that we are talking about today.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the intermediate range missile used to be seen as a hair trigger for nuclear war because of its short flight times. So now with the U.S. withdrawing from this treaty, does that mean we are moving closer to a nuclear disaster? Or some may argue that now the nuclear deterrence is not only in the hands of two or three superpowers, but also in the hands of some smaller nations, and that will make a nuclear war less likely to happen. What is your take?
Well, regarding your first question, it really depends on what United States and Russia would do next if the INF Treaty is eliminated. If both countries start to massively deploy medium-range ground-launched missiles, then that could really increase the risks of strategic instability. As you said, those missiles have shorter flight times, and it usually makes the other side extremely nervous would encourage one's enemy to put their nuclear weapons on higher alert. So the risk of overreaction, misunderstanding would grow dramatically. So that's a very negative. That will have very negative impact on strategic stability. But it's uncertain what United States and Russia would do next. It's possible that they will refrain from massively deploying such missiles. And in the American case, the United States still doesn't have a medium-range ground-launched missile to deploy. So it will take many years for them to develop and actually deploy such systems. So there is still time for diplomacy to work in order to mitigate the risk. In terms of your second question, whether the possession of nuclear weapons by smaller countries will make war less likely to take place, I think the answer is negative, because if more countries, especially smaller countries, get access to nuclear weapons, unlike the big powers, have great stakes in maintaining stability between themselves, so they have a stronger incentive to be extremely precautionary when it comes to nuclear wars. So they, in most cases, won't easily consider the nuclear option. But for smaller countries like India and Pakistan, they are dealing with their border dispute. There are constant clashes over their border, and as a result, the risk of some conventional military conflict escalating quickly to the nuclear level is actually greater. So many people believe there is a greater chance for nuclear war to break out between India and Pakistan than between any of the big powers. So the proliferation of nuclear weapons to more countries, I think in most cases, would have negative impact on global security and stability.
Mm-hmm. And also, the U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton once mentioned that the rising powers such as China means that there's a new strategic reality out there. So do you feel that the Trump administration's greatest worry is perhaps in Asia, in the Western Pacific?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the trigger of the recent U.S. Policy to withdraw from the INF Treaty is the reported violation of this treaty by Russia. With that said, the United States in recent years has been increasingly worried about China's medium-range missile capability, especially in the Asia-Pacific region, because China is not a member of this treaty, and therefore China is not prohibited from deploying such capabilities. And from the American perspective, the deployment of such missiles by China has helped China obtain military advantage, especially has helped strengthen China's so-called anti-access area denial capability. And that undermines American military superiority in this region. So there is some argument put forth by some quarters of the American security community that in order to counter this growing Chinese military concern, the U.S. needs to reconsider its INF position. So it is possible that China is playing some role behind the recent American policy shift.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Zhao Tong, a fellow in Carnegie's Nuclear Policy Program based at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy. Coming up, trade ministers to meet in Japan for the first CPTPP Commission meeting. You're listening to Today. We'll be back in a minute.
Ever worry that you'll miss out on breaking events? Tune in to Today to get the latest news and analysis on the important stories in China and around the globe. Today, illuminating the news that matters to you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. The first commission meeting of CPTPP, or Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, will be held in Tokyo, Japan on Saturday. Signatories will discuss how to make it easy for other countries to join the new Pacific Rim Trade Pact. The UK, Colombia, Indonesia, South Korea, and Thailand have shown interest in joining it. And right now in China, there is much talk about structural change, a key demand for the US during the trade war. In the meantime, some argue that joining the CPTPP would add more momentum to China's structural reform, as the country would have to align its policies with the pact. For more on this, we're now joined on the line by Wang Huiyao, President of the Center for China and Globalization. Dr. Wang, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you think will be high on the agenda on Saturday's meeting?
No, I think this is a great occasion now that since CPTPP is taking effective actually on the last day of 2018, and it's actually getting effective this year, the CPTPP wants to expand and wants to attract more members. So it's already now one of the largest trading blocks in the world, because the new trade pact will cover 500 million in population, and actually 11 countries already signed and will be enjoying the benefit and an obligation of CPTPP, but also that is covers about 13% of the total world GDP. So it's really a big building block for the liberalization of the trade and also investment, but particularly it emphasizes more on investment and also service. So I think that is really that's why it's become attractive. And also another thing about CPTPP is that it's not limited to the country from Asia. So as you mentioned, that countries like UK and also Colombia is also applying, but also South Korea and other countries are also lined up there. Thailand and even I understand that also I read somewhere even China and Taiwan showed interest some time ago. So it's really a new momentum actually to push the globalization forward. Multilateralism is still alive, and also in light of this WTO. Has been marginalized in the last number of years since the Doha round has not been been getting through for the last over 10, 15 years. So I think this new path actually shows the new standards and a new momentum for the for future of the global trade.
Mm-hmm. But do you think it is still as important, this new Pacific Rim Trade Pact is as important as is originally designed after the U.S. withdrawal?
Well, I think it's still very important because I think Japan has made some modification. I think one of the biggest modification is that in the past, it has to be 85% of the 12 GDP countries ratify the pact and then it become effective. So Japan changed that. Only 6 countries needed to pass their parliament approval, then it become effective. So 6 countries already approved that. So that's why it's become effective. And so the other countries are following to get it approved. So that's one major change. The other major change, I think Japan frozen about 20 clauses in the TPP. I think notably some of them, like the U.S. maybe wants a longer patent validity of the life expectancy for the some of the pharmaceutical and the medical patent or invention. So I think, some of the U.S. Requirement was not carried out in this agreement, but largely the TPP was not really changed so much. So it's still very effective, highly standard of new future trade agreement, actually, particularly for the service trade, which is very important for all the countries, also especially for China, as China is going to reach 60% of the GDP for service by the end of the 13th five-year plan. So I think that this new agreement covers the IPR protections, covers the digital economy, e-commerce, investment, environment protection, SOE reforms. So there's a lot of new things that China wants to do actually already being covered there in the agreement.
And as you mentioned earlier, several other countries have shown their interest in joining the CPTPP. So how does the prospect look like in terms of membership expansion, and what are the challenges there?
Well, I think for some of the countries to join, I think you have to overcome some of its domestic challenges. I think, for example, Vietnam become a member of the TPP, CPTPP is because also, you know, they have to do a lot of reform on itself, and also that there could be some special cases to be discussed with the TPP member countries, but you have to reach an agreement on that. So I think the challenge for China is really, is that some of the things that China probably it's already doing, and like IPR protection, like environment protection, like some of reforms and lower the service trade the barriers and digital economy, e-commerce. So many of the things that TPP talked about and reached agreement in this new agreement. Is actually China is trying going to be very strong in the future, like e-commerce and digital economy. So I think that in order for China to be part of that, I think it's also needs to talk with TPP member countries. But what's more important is that I think China carries a heavy weight because of the market contribution, the market size that China can bring to the CPTPP. Because if CPTPP at China, it can be a market of almost 2 billion people, and it will account about 25-30% of the global GDP. So that's really become attractive for other member countries. If China joins TPP, then there's more market access for them. There's more service company can come to China. But also, it's good for China as well. For example, China, you have Xiaomi, you have Lenovo, you have Huawei, ZTE, or Tencent, or Alibaba, and all those companies also want to go global. And there's no international agreement to protect them. That's why I think Huawei and ZTE is having a lot of challenges these days in different countries. But by having China joins TPP, then you'll be really have a protection of just like a WTO. Mm-hmm. So TPP would be regarded as a mini WTO for the service in the 21st century.
So you're a strong supporter for China to join the CPTPP, and some said that joining the CPTPP could be the answer for China to the China-US trade war. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think so, because some of the things, if a few years ago, probably is not right. But now China has realized, also because of these trade tensions with US and other countries, China is also determined to reform itself. Like we have lowered our auto tariff by half. Like we have recently allowed the foreign companies to have a more larger equity access, market access. We have approved more license for the financial services companies into China. China even allowed 100% Tesla to come into China. So a lot of things China is doing now is actually meet the standards of those international. Like TPP. So I think it could be an accelerator for China to reform. But also that I think since China is dealing with this with U.S. already, why can't we, by talking to a number of countries like TPP, so China can get larger market access to those countries. And also, so it serves both domestic reform, but also expand China's market overseas. So I think it's good on both sides. So as long as we start properly, and I think take cautious protections, really follow the right path of like President Xi has emphasized many times, China support a liberalization of the trade and the globalization. China is a strong supporter, and also I think the spokesperson of Minister of Commerce. I said, well, is any treaty or pact that facilitates the liberalization of the trade and investment, China is willing to consider and China is willing to see what it has happened.
Mm-hmm. And naturally, many believe that joining the CPTPP will facilitate China's structural change. But do you think China's structural reform will go in the exact direction that the West is seeking?
I think that I think joining the global trade system is one of the biggest experience and the success China has. For example, China joined the WTO in 2001, and since then China's GDP has gone up 12 times. The 90th Party Congress report said China is getting stronger and richer I think precisely China has actually embraced the globalization, and particularly, you know, those joining WTO, the international, you know, free trade agreement is really benefit China. So now we have a higher version. We have improved version of WTO, particularly on the service side. And over half of China's GDP is now on the service side. So I think it's time now for China to join TPP, and also it will serve as an accelerator for China's domestic reform, but also helping China to go global. So I think that it will actually fit China's agenda. But, you know, liberalization and free trade is not really dividing the West or East or China or Western. So it's all benefit to mankind as a whole, I think.
Thank you, Wang Huiyao, President of the Center for China and Globalization. Coming up, China to use its Long March 6 carrier rocket to launch 90 satellites for an Argentine company. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Stay with us.
With the great efforts made by the staff today become one of the great platforms for policy debates and information dissemination. And I wish today have an even brighter and greater tomorrow.
You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Now is Global Survey, where we look at what's happening around the world. Joining me in the studio is my colleague Patrick Flannery.
We begin in Asia, where universities in Thailand are seeing a surge in Chinese applications as students look for alternatives to Western schools. A Chinese kindergarten teacher in Qingdao, who was fired for being gay, is suing to get his job back.
In Oceania, unusual road signs in Sydney are warning commuters of extreme heat, with the four-letter word WOLO, W-O-L-O, which doesn't stand for anything. Australia's richest man, Anthony Pratt, celebrated a business deal by tweeting a video of himself dancing.
In Africa, climate change is putting more than half the world's coffee beans at risk of extinction, especially in places like Ethiopia, scientists find. At least 30 people have been abducted by separatists in an English-speaking region of Cameroon.
Turning to the Middle East, the Saudi-backed Yemeni government met with the Iran-backed Houthi movement to discuss a prisoner exchange that would reunite thousands of families. Trade between Qatar and Turkey hit $2 billion U.S. dollars last year, an increase of 50% from 2017.
In Europe, Ukraine could lose its statehood if divisions there continue to disrupt the former Soviet Republic. That's according to Russia's top security official. A scarf knitted to symbolize Germany's notorious train delays has sold on eBay for more than $8,000.
Look into Latin America. The presidents of Brazil and Argentina have agreed to oppose Venezuela's authoritarian government, calling President Nicolas Maduro a dictator. In its first issue this year, National Geographic magazine has named a bookshop in Buenos Aires the world's most beautiful bookstore.
Finally, in North America tonight, a man is charged after prosecutors say he blew a hole in the White House using a rocket, then stormed the building with guns and grenades. And for the seventh straight year, visa overstays outnumbered illegal border crossings. That's according to the Center for Migration Studies of New York.
Thank you, Patrick. That's the Global Headlines survey for today. China will use its Long March 6 carrier rocket for several launches to place 90 satellites into orbit for an Argentine company, a landmark achievement for China in the international space market. China Great Wall Industry Corporation announced on Wednesday that it recently multiple launches services agreement with Satellogic, a private Argentine company specializing in Earth observation satellites. 13 satellites are set to be launched in September or October this year. Remaining launches will follow on a quarterly basis. The Long March 6, a small Chinese liquid fuel rocket, has flown twice, most recently in November 2017. For more on this, we are now joined by Dr. Zhang Fan, Associate Professor of Astronomy Department of Beijing Normal University, and Nicholas Demin, Professor with the University of Buenos Aires and Government Advisor in Argentina. So gentlemen, good morning and good evening. So, Professor John, could you first of all tell us more about this Long March 6? What are some of its main features of this type of rocket?
Well, Long March 6 is one of the new family of rockets that's being developed in China. So, in the family, you also have Long March 5 and Long March 7. All the family of rockets use essentially the same engine technology and uses kerosene and liquefied oxygen as fuel. So basically, the fuel is non-toxic, so it's very environmentally friendly. And Long March 6 is the smallest in the family. It's designed to take satellites of up to a ton or slightly over into something called Sun Synchronous Orbit. So that's where most of the utility satellites will be. So it's essentially specifically designed to take utility satellites up into their place.
And also, this is said to be the first time the Long March 6 will perform launch services for international clients. So what does this mean for Long March 6?
So the earlier two launches you mentioned, so the first one launched 20 little satellites from various Chinese universities into space. And then the second one launched three larger ones from a province into space. So this time is a commercial client and it's international client. So it's very good. It shows that Long March 6 is mature enough to enter into the market. And it's also competitive enough to win over large contracts. So this is a pretty substantial contract. 90 satellites doesn't mean 90 launches because the satellites are pretty small. You can stuff something like 10, 15 of them into the same rocket. But still, on the order of 10 rockets will be pretty substantial contract. So that's a very good start for Long March 6.
And Professor Damon, what do you make of the significance of this move for both countries?
Yes. I think it's very important for the Argentinian side because in this space exploration program, China and Argentina work together, and Argentinian Space Commission, National Space Commission for Argentina, has the possibility to use 10% of the time of the base to continue our own space program. So this is very important for us because Argentina is the leader country in South America in the space exploration. We produce our satellites. We produce all the technological parts of the program. But we need the Chinese support in order to continue exploring further, not only the moon, also Mars. Mm-hmm. So this Argentinian government supports a lot of the program, and Argentinian universities and Argentinian Space Commission use the base to work with the Chinese technicians in order to continue the cooperation plan.
Yeah, and Professor Zhang, what will be the mission of these 90 satellites after they are in orbit?
So as I understand, they will form a remote sensing constellation for for this company, SatLogic, to provide essentially real-time pictures of Earth, covering almost the entire Earth. Their aim is to provide real-time data on things like crop situation, on whether forest is on fire, that sort of thing. So you don't need very high-resolution pictures. You don't need big satellites for them, but you need real-time pictures to know whether at this moment the tree's on fire or not. So it's preferable to have a large number of small satellites keeping an eye on almost every part of Earth at any time. So that's why there are so many.
Mm-hmm. And Professor John, how would you assess China's competitiveness compared with other major space players when it comes to commercial space launch services it is able to provide?
So China has the advantage that it has multiple families of rockets, different generations. So whatever the weight of the satellite, whatever thing you want to launch into space, there is going to be a rocket for you, and there's going to be backup, older generation backup rockets for you if you need them. So that's one thing. Another thing is this Long March 6 is designed with commercial aim in mind. So it's designed to be as structurally simple as possible, therefore to increase its reliability. It's supposed to be more reliable than anything that China has built, and that's already pretty good track record. So insurance costs will probably be lower. And also, Long March 6 is designed to be able to launch very quickly. It can be launched from a truck. And the preparation period is something like 7 days. And this is very important in the future. For example, if this constellation that SatLogic is launching has one of the satellites breaking down and it needs to be replaced very quickly, then Walmart 6 can do this very good, very well. As for cost effectiveness, obviously there are very strong competitors like SpaceX with the reusable rocket technology. But in the long run, who knows? Long March 6, as I said, shares the same engines with lots of other rockets. So the engines can be produced in mass numbers, in bulk. So in the end, which one wins out depends on, I guess, how many times you can reuse the engines, how successful the success rate of recovery of the engines, and how much fuel you waste recovering each engine, that sort of factors. So in the future, even the cost effectiveness, the Long March family may still be pretty good.
And Professor Damian, you've mentioned earlier that China has built a satellite and space mission control station in Argentina, and that actually played a key role in China's exploration of the far side of the moon. So could you tell us more about this control station, and what do you make of the potential of the two countries' cooperation in this field?
Yes, actually, a few weeks ago, the President Xi Jinping visited Argentina for the G20, and also he official visit to Argentina, and our two countries signed more than 30 agreements in order to have a new cooperation plan for the next 4 years. In this plan, we have a nuclear cooperation, a technological cooperation, and also we continue with our space exploration plan. So nowadays, the base, the Chinese deep exploration base in Neuquén, is part of a broader plan with the cooperation in our two countries in different levels, in the technological level related to the space industry, and also because Argentina president was very clear that the security of China is important for Argentina, and also this possibility to develop the Chinese technology for localization using a satellite is also a very important possibility for Argentina in order to improve our technological industry. Argentina, we do have electronic industry, we do have a nuclear industry, and this improvement made by the Chinese scientists are also very important for us because nowadays, in order to do space research, you need a lot of resources. And it's not easy for a small, middle-sized country like Argentina to do it by their own. And this kind of international cooperation is the best way to improve our solidarity links between our two countries and also to improve our scientific agenda in order to have welfare and, between our two countries.
And Professor John, why does China choose Argentina as the place to build this control station?
Apart from the warm relationship between the two countries, the geographic factor is also kind of interesting because it's always often said by Americans that if you dig through Earth, you come up in China, but that's not actually the case for both in the Northern Hemisphere. If you dig through Earth directly,
who can reach Argentina, right?
Yeah, you reach Argentina. So we see exactly opposite side of the sky. So having a control station in Argentina is effectively the most cost effective way to have the least number of stations to be able to see the most part of the sky. So that's actually quite interesting.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Zhang Fan, Associate Professor of Astronomy Department of Beijing Normal University, and Nicholas Stemmen, Professor with the University of Buenos Aires and Government Advisor in Argentina. Thank you both for joining our discussion this evening. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Michael Zhang. Greetings from Los Angeles of the Golden State of California. Thank you today for making me part of your team. I truly enjoy the debates we had and look forward to many more in the years to come.
What matters to China increasingly matters to the world. Keep up to date with the latest news and events about the Middle Kingdom with the China Plus app. Up-to-the-minute reports, live streaming audio, insightful opinion on everything China-related, facts, figures, and language learning resources at your fingertips. Everything in focus, all in one place. Search for China Plus in the App Store or Google Play.
You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Many at the White House are resisting House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's request that President Donald Trump postpone his State of the Union address. Pelosi asked Trump to reschedule the annual policy speech, citing security concerns stemming from what is now the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Homeland Security Secretary Christian Nelson said the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Secret Service are fully prepared to support and secure the State of the Union. The shutdown was triggered by a budget standoff in which Trump requested nearly $6 billion for building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, with congressional Democrats rejecting his demand. And now being with us is Einar Tungen, author and columnist. So, Einar, does Pelosi have a point about security concerns at the State of the Union address due to the shutdown, or is it purely a political fight?
Well, it's mostly a political fight. Quite frankly, I don't know that it would be an issue. Obviously, the people who would have to serve in this would do so without pay, but they would be required to do it. But the larger point she's making is that Congress is a co-equal branch, and the State of the Union address is by invitation. Both the House and the Senate have to pass a joint resolution inviting the president to Congress to give the State of the Union. So she's underlining a point. Now, she's been very careful. She says, I didn't disinvite you. But unless they actually pass that invitation at the House level, he's actually not invited.
But why is Pelosi targeting the State of the Union in particular?
Well, I mean, I think there's this feeling that Trump has been trying to use the bully pulpit. He's requested free airtime and things like this. He wants just to make another case on there. Quite frankly, given the performance last time, it would probably be to the Democrats' advantage to let him try to make another case for it, because as we speak, his poll numbers are going down, even among his most fervent admirers. He's starting to lose ground. So I think she's just trying to make sure that she's underlining a point, that she's not being rude, but she's trying to draw more attention to the fact that this is Donald Trump's shutdown, not hers.
Mm-hmm. And who actually has the final say on whether to postpone the speech or not? I mean, does the president has the right to do so? And are there similar cases before?
Well, quite frankly, he can schedule whatever he wants and do it from the White House. But that would break years of tradition, and it would be very highly unusual. And it would once again draw attention to the fact that the political process in D.C. is not working, and that he's in the eyes of the vast majority, now getting way above 50%, responsible for this current impasse.
Mm-hmm. And could this move have any counter effect on Pelosi and the House Democrats?
Well, if she had just said you're disinvited, I think it would. But the way she's phrased it by saying that I think we should postpone it, we should talk, is taking the softer approach. She's pointing out that she is trying to be very sensitive to the shutdown of people who are involved in it, that she's willing to negotiate. And it's going to be up to Trump now to say what his next move is.
And I think some of us may get a little dizzy to hear all the comments from American politicians and human stories from U.S. media outlets about the shutdown. So what would you say are the general tactics for the two parties to pocket more political gains and to win this battle?
Well, unfortunately, there's no winning the battle. This is like tariffs. There are 800,000 people who are not getting a paycheck. Many of these people do not have a lot of wealth. They have not saved money. They're in danger of missing payments on their cars, on their house. Some of them have concerns about buying medication, things like that. Today, Trump signed a bill saying that during the shutdown, these people will be reimbursed after it's done. But then this begs the question, if you're going to pay them, why not let them actually do their job? So it's on both sides, they're counting on it. Donald Trump has painted himself into a corner. He's made this an issue. Originally, he was delivered a bill that he authorized McConnell, the leader of the Senate and the Republicans, to do. Now McConnell is sitting on the sidelines because he's quite, frankly, he doesn't know what to do. Every time he puts together a package, Donald Trump is influenced by Rush Limbaugh or Ann Coulter, who says, oh, he's giving in, he's caved, and he immediately flips. So it's very hard to deal with them. And that's not just on this issue. This China is facing the same issue when it comes to trade tariffs.
Well, a recent CNBC report quotes a White House official as saying that the shutdown would subtract 0.1 percentage point from economic growth every week. So how would you see the impact of the shutdown on U.S. economy and society?
Well, the psychological impact is probably even greater than the financial one because people become concerned. You know, there's no predictability. And this is something that has been a feature of the Donald Trump administration, especially on the international scale. But now he's brought it back home domestically. Remember, there's one out of every four people knows or is being affected by this shutdown. So this is a populist issue. People don't want ordinary people to suffer. Remember, Donald Trump was elected by people who thought that these big entities and these people who believed in these ideologies were willing to sacrifice ordinary people. So in many ways, he's going against his own grain. And at some point, he's going to have to settle for something. The question is when and what it'll be.
But it's argued that this means a lot to President Trump politically because he cannot afford to lose the battle over the border wall. What do you think?
He's lost the battle. I mean, he started out, it was going to cost $25 million. He wanted a concrete wall. Now it's become a fence. The $5.6 billion that he's asking for won't get the job that he said he would do done. Most Americans don't favor the wall. They don't see it as effective. They favor something that combines technology with physical barriers that can be much more effective. So at this point, he has to salvage something, but he does not want to be accused of caving. He wants to be strong. One Republican senator has already called and said, look, just declare a state of emergency. Forget everything else. You know, these people need to go back to work because this impasse could go on forever. If he's not willing to budge and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are not willing to budge, this is going to hurt a lot of people.
So eventually, who do you think would blink first, the president or the Democrats?
I think it'll be Donald Trump. His classic style is to try to create other issues. I mean, he's going to be announcing with a few days a summit with Young Kim from North Korea. I think this will give a lot of impetus for him to do something good with China. And by that, I mean, reach some sort of understanding, at least on a couple of year basis. That will help the markets go up. But eventually he has to deal with this. And he's in a position where he's losing support on a daily basis. And this is becoming a liability, not only for him, but the Republican Party as a whole. Already you have a large block of middle line Democrats and Republicans saying we need to solve this. This is not fair to the people. And this is going to hurt our election.
Thank you, Einar Tungen, author and columnist. Let's take a short break here. Coming back, China is seeking a sea change in consumption patterns of wealthy individuals, and Japan's robot hotel fires over half of its robotic workers. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
For breaking news and the stories that matter to you, check out our Twitter page and follow us by searching China Plus News. We focus on the Middle Kingdom.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Now joining us for other news is Patrick Flannery again.
Well, how do China's richest people spend their money? Zhao Ying, you're pretty rich. How do you spend your money?
I'm not rich.
Well, typically,
I don't have much money to spend.
Well, those who do spend it on two things, traveling and reading. That's according to the Shanghai-based WhoRun report. The report looks at wealth and how it's spent, and it asked 465 of China's super rich what they loved spending money on more than anything else. 20% said traveling, with half of those people going for tourism packages. And here's what we know about traveling and reading. We know both activities expand a person's worldview and their understanding of people, culture, and places.
So where are they traveling?
Well, the report didn't really break down the specifics, but the New York Times recently found that more Chinese are visiting the United States than ever before, with New York City among the top locations. 1.1 million Chinese visited New York City last year. That's quite an increase. More Chinese travel internationally than anyone else in the world. Asian destinations are preferred, though Italy and the U.S. are among the most popular.
So how have Chinese spending habits changed over time?
Well, the report's founder said that cars, handbags, watches, these all used to be the items. You would show off your wealth. Not anymore. Now the investment is in taking trips. We also know that China is home to 32 of the 40 fastest growing cities in the world, known as high net worth cities. The country is second only to the U.S. there. Here's what's really curious about the super rich in China. The people with the most money are the least happy. This year marks a five-year low on the happiness index for millionaires in China. Why? They're concerned about business due to the trade tension with the United States. Still, they are optimistic when it comes to property investments over the long term. So after traveling and reading, buying property is something China's super rich will continue to pursue.
Okay, what about sharing some of their money with us? Will that make them happier?
That was my question for you, but apparently it was misguided. So sorry about that.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic.
Well, you know, we talk a lot on this show about job security, especially with federal workers being furloughed in the United States, working without a paycheck and so forth. But unemployment is now hitting a new demographic, robots. More than 100 robots were laid off this week at a Tokyo hotel. The hotel was run almost exclusively by a staff of robots until now. Half of them have been fired. They just weren't cutting it, weren't up to the task of running the hotel smoothly, and that's because they weren't people. For instance, Churi was her name. Churi was more trouble than she was worth. The robot was found in every hotel room, turned out to be a terrible personal assistant, could not answer questions that Alexa or Siri could answer. So Churi was laid off, along with 100 others. With the rise of artificial intelligence, we're now seeing the frustrations with the technology playing out. AI has its own learning curve, we're finding out, its own growing pains.
So what problems was the hotel encountering with the robots that make them determine it is time to hire actual people?
Well, it was easier to fire the robots than to replace them. That would have cost too much. So who better than a human to answer the questions in the lobby? Also, human bellhops are way better, as the hotel discovered. The robotic luggage carriers kept getting stuck in the rain and the snow, and many of them never could find the hotel rooms to begin with.
So does this mean that AI is not going to threaten our jobs in the future?
It's interesting. The McKinsey firm predicted 800 million employees will be replaced by AI in the next decade. Now, that sounds very Orwellian, but the good news is that only 5% of those jobs can be fully automated. It means 4 or 5% can be completely replaced by robots. Running a hotel clearly is not one of them, and AI, we know, will not solve every problem for us. The website Quartz pointed out today that Uber's self-driving car killed someone last year. So we know some of the darker side of AI, and also research has shown several times that racial and gender biases are present in facial recognition.
Okay, thank you, Patrick. That's all the time for this edition of Today. The United States is set to start its withdrawal from the INF Treaty with Russia next month. Trade ministers to meet in Japan for the first CPTPP Commission meeting. China to use its Long March 6 carrier rocket to launch 90 satellites for an Argentine company. Democrats asked Donald Trump to delay State of the Union speech. To listen to this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. The program engineer of this episode is Yaqing. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening.